So the topic for this evening is that of thinking, thoughts, and it's a continuation of the discussion on this topic that we've had the last 2 weeks before this. And the idea is that the world of thinking is a very important one for human beings in general, but in particular for meditators who need to get a good perspective on their thoughts, on thinking, their relationship to thinking, understand the many different facets of thinking, in order to learn how to work with it, and so that thinking is not it doesn't interfere with their efforts to meditate, or doesn't interfere with the spiritual life. And rather, thinking, wise thinking, can actually be very supportive of Buddhist practice, supportive of Buddhist practice, and supportive of meditation practice. And so I thought we would, if it's okay with you, I would like to continue next week and try to talk about actually wise thinking, which is an unusual topic in meditation, because usually in meditation we talk about letting go of thoughts. Sometimes you get the impression, if you hang around Buddhist teachers enough like me, that you're supposed to be dumb and stupid and not think at all, and just let go of your thoughts and just be present, you know. I think that thinking is a very important part of Buddhism, and having good critical thinking abilities and wise ways of thinking is an important part of any spiritual life, any life at all. But because we emphasize so much letting go of thoughts in meditation, then people get maybe the wrong idea that they're not supposed to engage in thinking mind at all. So anyway, that's for next week. And for this week, I want to talk more about the usual thing, you know, letting go part of thoughts. Thinking is an important part of human life, and it can be a great hindrance. It can be a great source of tremendous problems and evil in life, stress and suffering. It can also be the source of a vehicle for some of the most beautiful things that human beings are capable of. But whether it's a source of suffering or source of delight and joy, the primary thing the mind is caught up in, then it's very hard to develop or settle into meditative states, to get really deep into meditation. It's very hard to see very clearly when the glass we're looking through, in a sense, is a filter of thoughts, or is smudged over with a lot of thinking. And the analogy I like to use for the switch from being primarily preoccupied with thoughts and relating to the world and to ourselves through our thinking, to an experience of relating to ourselves beyond or wider than the world of thinking, is the analogy of someone who's born inside a house, never leaves the house, the curtains are drawn, and every room of the house has a 52-inch television screen, and they have cable or satellite or something, and so there's 500 channels. You know, there's a lot of television shows to watch. So of course they get bored after a while, but then they just switch the channel. And there's lots of things to watch, and someone comes along and says, "Hey, you know, there's a whole world outside of your house to explore." And they say, "Oh no, this is really interesting. I could, you know, change the channel." And so it's very captivating and very involved. The whole world, you know, for a lifetime, decades, the person, you know, is living inside this very interesting two-dimensional world of television, kind of watching it. And then finally, after 53 years. There's a power failure in the neighborhood, and so there's no television to watch. And so the person occurs to the person, "Well, there's this door there. I never looked outside the door. Maybe I should look." And so the person goes out through the door and into the neighborhood. And in fact, there's these beautiful trees and green leaves, and there's a wonderful feeling of the breeze against the cheeks and the warmth of the sun, and all these wonderful things, three-dimensional things that the person had no idea about, because they're always, relating to that two-dimensional world of television. So the same thing with the world of our thoughts. The world of our thoughts can be amazingly varied. We probably have more channels in our minds than there are television channels currently. And so it can be quite varied and very captivating. There's a tremendous compelling quality for some people around their thinking. There's a kind of I think for some people, a tremendous sense of promise in the world of thinking, that somehow thinking is going to provide the solutions and answers to our life. And if we can just think our way into things, that's why sometimes our thinking can be so repetitive, because we can be convinced that thinking is going to be the solution, is how we're going to find the answer. And thinking is how we build up our sense of self to a great degree, or protect the sense of self, or engage in a whole kind of convoluted, complicated ideas about who we are. It has a lot to do with the world of desire, because many times our desires are mediated through what we think in our thinking. It has a lot to do with the world of ill will or hate or anger, because anger and ill will is often mediated through the world of our thinking. So it can be quite compelling and quite involving. But to have a switch, and there can be a kind of a very clear, some people have a very clear switch where their preoccupation or their relationship to the world switches from being primarily involved or preoccupied with thinking to being much more broader. Kind of, you no longer feel entangled or caught in the world of thoughts. And many people don't realize how caught they are in the world of thoughts. It's like the fish doesn't see the water it swims in, they say. And so we don't often sometimes see how much we're living and swimming in a world of thinking and thoughts. And so we might not even see there's a problem, what's an issue. This television is quite wonderful. But then there can be this moment, this time, when there's a shift in the mind, and the mind separates itself somehow from it being so closely tied, velcroed, to our thinking. And the kind of pulling away separation, and say, oh, there's thinking is going on. And there can be a very clear recognition, there's thinking. And in a sense, I'm here watching, there's the watcher, there's attention. And the attention is different than the thought. There's a separation, a distance that is created, a healthy distance. If you always had your nose glued to the television set, it'd be healthy to step back 10 feet. And he goes, oh, I'm watching television. So many times we have our nose glued to our thinking. And to step back and realize, oh, I'm thinking. And it can lead, with the right kind of perspective on it, it can lead to a sense of freedom, or a sense of ease, or a sense of, finally, wow, I'm a little bit not so caught in that world. A different perspective of the same thing can analyze or judge what it's like to be caught in the world of thinking. Thinking might still be going on, even though we're not caught by it so much. We're stepped out of its orbit, in a sense. But the thinking might be very uncomfortable. And sometimes only when there's strong mindfulness, and you kind of separate yourself a little bit from the entanglement or the preoccupation with thoughts, that we realize that the way we're thinking is not so comfortable, that it's exhausting or tiring or stressful or has other kind of consequences for us. And so then from that perspective, some people will get upset. Oh no, this is terrible. It shouldn't be this way. I'm stressed out. It affects my body, it affects my mood, it affects so much of who I am. But I'd like to suggest that rather than getting depressed by what you see, being able to see clearly what's there, it's actually you can start appreciating that little bit of freedom that begins to occur, that things you see there. Wow, I'm not as caught up in it. I'm a little bit independent from that whole world of thinking. So one of the ways to do this is to help create that little bit of sense of independence is to use mental noting. It's a technique we used in this tradition of meditation, some people use it, which is very quietly, in the quiet or subtly or weakly, or very, very, very softly, say to yourself, in your mind, thinking, or planning, or worrying, or remembering, or something. Just very, very simple. Very obvious kind of label for what's going on. And if you label clearly enough, and maybe repeated enough, sometimes it takes a while, but the labeling itself is a kind of a recognizing of what's going on, that the recognizing is not the thing that's being recognized. So you might be caught up in some kind of preoccupation, planning what you're going to do tomorrow. And it's really important, some big meeting, you're worried about something, and you're really caught by that. But then you say to yourself, planning. Here is a human being that's planning. I'm planning. If you do that often enough and regularly enough, at some point you might begin to pull yourself out of the way that you're entangled in the world of your planning, or whatever the thought is. So one technique is just use the noting. And the trick with the noting also, the advantage of the noting can be, is if you listen to the tone of voice and the quality of how you do the noting, it'll teach you about whether you've continued to be reactively involved or caught to whatever you're noting, or whether you're a little bit more equanimous about it. So, if you're planning and you're just tired of all this planning, it's not going to be done, a thousand times now, and you say, planning. That's an indication that you have some reaction to it. Or if you're having some wonderful fantasy of desire, and you just go, oh, desire. it's also an indication that you're a little caught by it. You're a little bit kind of, and the idea is just planning, very soft, very kind of equanimous, just kind of independent. Oh, there it is, planning, there it is, fantasy, fantasizing. Until you start feeling a little bit, you're not quite drowning in this experience. You're not quite kind of submerged in the experience of thinking. So it's very quiet. Another way to do this is to focus on something which is not your thinking. And so, for example, one of the preeminent techniques in the world of meditation is to focus on your breathing, which works for some people very well. Your physical felt sense experience of breathing, whether it's in your nostril, your chest, or your belly, or anywhere you feel the physical experience of breathing, that physical sensation of breathing is not a thought. You can think about your breathing, but the felt sense is not a thought. So if you put if you try to put as much attention as you can into the felt sense of your breathing somewhere in your body, then that activity, that energy, that food of attention that you have is being directed into something which is not your thinking. And attention is kind of like food. And so if your food keeps going into thinking, you're going to feed the world of thinking. But if your attention is going to something else, then you're not feeding the world of your thinking. And then it can be very slow initially, but then with time, you stop feeding and reinforcing your thinking. So in this regard, I like to distinguish between thinking, which most of us, I think, know what is well enough, and thoughting, which is not an English word yet. All right, thoughting is what the mind does. The mind is a thoughting machine. It just, just that's what it does. It makes thoughts, bubbles them up. But thinking is when we get involved in our thinking, with the thoughts. We react to it, we pick it up, we get involved in it, we add to it, we make other associations to it. And we've somehow been, carried off with that thought. So each time you come back to your breathing, you're taking at least a moment where you're not reinforcing that involvement with the world of thinking. And so since you're not reinforcing it, you're not feeding it. And if thoughts don't get fed, they don't turn into thinking. They just, a thought bubbles up and it's just there. It disappears. And so the more you can put your attention on the breath, the less there is attention to feed your thinking. And thinking kind of recedes to the background and gets quieter and quieter, has less and less food to keep it going. So so basically ignoring your thinking the best you can and keep coming back to your breathing and focusing that felt sense of your breath and really kind of trying to be diligent, try to sustain the attention there as long as you can. Now, of course, your mind's going to wander off in thought as you do that. And then there has to be this wisdom not to get reactive to that fact. Just, I'm thinking, kind of let's go back, direct the attention back to the breathing. It's common in Buddhist circles, people say, let go of your thoughts, and then go back to the breath. Some people don't have a clue how to let go of their thinking. And some people do. Some people can just kind of, for the moment at least, kind of turn it off or stop that activity and go back to the breath. Some people don't have a clue, don't have any ability to turn off their thinking. But they do have the ability to direct their attention again wholeheartedly into the breath. For a moment, 2 moments, 3 moments. And every moment you turn your attention away from your thinking into the world of your breath, it counts, it's significant, for beginning to take the food, the fuel, away from that thinking. With time, slowly, slowly, there's less and less food for your thoughts, and the thoughts get quieter and quieter. It's very rare that someone has the ability to push some mental button and just turns off their thoughts. I think there's sometimes the wish among meditators that they find that button. But I don't think there is such a button. And so you have to be very wise about the presence of thoughts and very relaxed about it. Don't get caught up in being reactive to it. But there has to be some clear sense, very clear sense for meditators, that the world of thinking is not the useful place to be while you meditate. There has to be a very clear conviction that's the case. And that takes some reflection, it takes talking with teachers, it takes maybe reading books about meditation, to really understand in principle that thinking is not the purpose of meditation. If you thought that, if we tell you thinking is the purpose of meditation, then you probably think better. But the idea is that if you're really convinced, you know, that meditation is something else, then there can at least be in principle the willingness to disconnect with the world of thinking and then engage in something different. And so what the different thing here, I'm suggesting perhaps, is the breath. And focus on your breathing. And then the mind goes back and forth, you know, the thoughts get the upper hand for a while, they come into the foreground, and you notice that, you put the breath back in the foreground, and there's a kind of a rhythm that can, I like to think of it as a rhythm, and you're working the rhythm. Rather than thinking it's unfortunate your mind wanders away into thought again, think of it, oh, it's part of that rhythm of coming and going, breathing in, breathing out is a rhythm, there's a rhythm to being wandering off in the thought, there's a rhythm, part of the rhythm, you come back into your breath again, and there's a rhythm there. And you're just going to participate in that rhythm, get a sense of the rhythm. Buddhists got rhythm. And so rather than being discouraged when your mind wanders away, as soon as you notice your mind's wandered away, it's, oh, good, now it's my chance to participate in this dance, and I'm going to set the rhythm back in the other direction. And you do it the best you can. And after a while, doing that over and over and over again, you get better and better at staying longer and longer with your breath over time. You can't just push a button and just stay with your breath just like that if you're relatively new to meditation. And with time, you kind of stay longer and longer. And so, so then a number of things can happen in relation to our thinking as we do this. One is that, there's less and less food going to thinking. And rather than being turned off, thinking, the world of thinking begins to thin out. It becomes thinner and thinner. And weaker and weaker. More and more transparent. And it can seem, maybe for the uninitiated, if people haven't experienced this, it's kind of strange to talk this way. But when I'm really caught up in my thoughts, there's a way in which they seem really serious, important, substantial. As like they're the main game in town. As the thinking gets thinner and thinner, or weaker and weaker, they become more and more transparent. And they have less and less sense of promise or allure or compulsion as part of them. And you start seeing that thoughts are just thoughts, which is an amazing thing to see. Seems like so obvious, right? A thought is just a thought, which means a thought doesn't have to be believed. A thought is not necessarily true or false. A false is not something that needs to be engaged in. A thought is just this very simple thing, phenomena, bubbling up in the mind. And Buddhists sometimes talk about when the mind is quite quiet and not caught up in the world of thoughts, that thoughts can feel like clouds drifting through an empty sky. And, you know, thoughts are kind of insubstantial. I have a joke with my 4-year-old son that if I could lift him up really high, outside, that he has to be careful because I'm going to bump him against the clouds. And he tells, Daddy, don't be so silly. because you don't hurt yourself when you bump into clouds. So you have to realize a thought is just a thought. There's a story that's told in the Vipassana circles. I think it was about an Indian meditation teacher. I turned to a woman, a student, meditation student, and said to her, and he had her attention, and said to her, the thought of your mother is not your mother. And that helped her a lot. Are thoughts accurate? Are they accurate representation of reality? Are they, you know, what are they? The thought is not your mother. Certainly, substantially, it's not. Your mother is there and you're here, and the thought is something different, right? But we relate sometimes to reality through the filter of our thinking, and we think that our thoughts are reality. Because that's how we mediate. Many people mediate realities through the world of their thinking. But the world becomes three-dimensional when you can have enough independence from thinking to see it. When it gets thin enough or weak enough, you can see it as something, as a thought is just a thought. A thought is insubstantial. How much weight does a thought have? What color does a thought have? Well, some people are all kinds of colors they see, but they're pretty insubstantial stuff. The content, the story, the idea that's embedded in the thought is pretty insubstantial. Sometimes when I've taught the intro class, I say that no one's ever seen a thought, really. I mean, no one's ever taken a photograph of it, right? So, you can't hold a photograph and say, this is what a thought looks like. And there's, secondary kind of evidence of thinking, I guess, with brain scans, and because people speak and write, but really see a thought? And imagine, NASA sends a probe into deeper space, and they have this new device, and somehow they're floating far out in intergalactic space. There's a thought. And it's just an amazing thing. And they take a photograph of this thought, and they email it back, send it back to the Earth. And the newspapers all over the world, will print it, a thought. Finally, we've seen a thought. Isn't it an amazing thing? Thoughts are amazing. In fact, I think it's just an amazing product of evolution, of nature, of the world, that we should have thinking. And, I like to say it's, whatever you're thinking about this moment, it's the result of 5 billion years of evolution. in terms of certain kind of thinking, the particular thought you're having right now is the pinnacle of 5 billion years of evolution. It's come down to this, you thinking about pizza. It's awesome. And to have a little perspective and humor around thinking is important. But to somehow begin to, it gets weaker, thinner, we no longer believe, we don't have to believe every thought we have. Some people believe their thoughts are themselves. That's who they are. Because if you don't have a thought to tell you who you are, then how do you know who you are? If you don't have a thought telling you who you are, then who are you? Have you ever thought about that? If you can't answer the question with a thought, then who are you? That's a good question, right? Who are you before your parents were born? What's your face before your parents are born? And so this world starts becoming three-dimensional at some point. So one thing is the world of thinking becomes thinner. The other is a shift that can happen between being kind of living in the world of thinking and feeling now you're independent of it. You're separated from it. And as that happens, that's a very important point in meditation, because then it can be you turn a corner in meditation, and then it's easier and easier to make a choice not to be involved in the world of thinking, not to put all your energy into the world of thinking, and your energy can go into something else. And what it can go into is a much more 360-degree awareness, a more broader three-dimensional kind of sense of being alive, of our experience here and now. And at that point, meditation can become much more satisfying way of being alive, being present, than the satisfaction of thinking. If thinking is your only satisfaction, your source of satisfaction in life, my suggestion is it's two-dimensional. And there's something much, much more satisfying, much, much more satisfying way of being, which is we're not caught up in the world of thinking. We might still be thinking, but thinking is just a small part of who we are. There's a much richer, more fuller aspect of what's going on. As the world of thoughts gets thinner, and as we don't feel so identified in the world of thinking, then we start getting a sense that we're much more than thoughts. And an interesting aspect of this can be that we become aware that there's a sense of well-being, satisfaction, a sense of peace that exists independent from the world of thinking. And sometimes that sense of peace or well-being that's independent of the world of thinking can eventually seem so much more satisfying than anything you can possibly think about. And then there can be a greater and greater willingness to let go of that world of thinking. And it can be frightening for some people to do that because their whole sense of who they are and their relationship to the world is through that filter of their thinking. But then to kind of let go of it and start experiencing this very, very rich, very satisfying experience of silence or stillness or peace, that's possible. And that itself can then kind of open up to whole new realms. I think of meditation kind of like an hourglass sometimes. That the two-dimensional world, television world of thinking can seem huge, like this huge, big opening of the hourglass. And then it can seem that as you get into meditation, close your eyes, you're kind of narrowing your world, a smaller and smaller world, you know, very narrow and claustrophobic for some people maybe even, you know, until you kind of begin separating yourself from the world of thinking. And then it opens up again, and it becomes vast again. It becomes even vaster than the other end of the hourglass. Isn't that neat? You're sitting there with your eyes closed, and there's just this vast universe. You can feel, you know, the sense of vastness is greater than anything that you can actually experientially sense if you're experiencing the world through thinking. So then there certainly are times in meditation where various kinds of thinking does come to a stop. And one of the forms of meditation that can really stop very clearly is discursive thinking, where you're thinking about anything about that's going on elsewhere. You're not having a conversation in your mind anymore. You're not thinking about anything that's distant and far away. But anything that we call discursive or conversational thinking actually comes to rest. It's not stopped. There's not a lid put on it. It's not resisted. It just comes to rest. It settles out. And after the discursive thinking drops away, the subtler thinking that can be left, which might be primarily concerned with what's happening here and now, can also become quieter and quieter. And some people will report that periods of time in meditation where there seems to be absolutely no thinking going on whatsoever. Sometimes if a teacher will ask the person, but look more carefully, and they'll find, well, actually, if they look more carefully, there are very, very subtle thoughts still going on. So, for example, you can have the thought, you can sit quietly in meditation and have the thought, I'm not thinking anything right now. And you believe it, you know, because thoughts can camouflage themselves. They're very subtle and very slippery sometimes. So they can be very, very subtle thoughts that we don't really see that are going on. Now, why is this important to do all this? One of the reasons why it's important is that as long as we're caught up in our thoughts, we're caught up. There's a world of stress, the world of suffering. And one of the vehicles, one of the ways of becoming free of suffering, free of clinging, free of fear, free of hate, free of desire, so we're not in the grip of those things, is to have a different relationship to the world of thinking. So, for example, a thought can arise in your mind, and it doesn't have to go anywhere. You don't have to act on it. You could walk, you could walk by an ice cream parlor and say, and have a thought, it'd be nice to have an ice cream now, and say, oh, a thought is just a thought. That's an interesting thought. 5 billion years of evolution. Ice cream thought, that's nice. As opposed to having somehow allowing that thought to be picked up and acted on. And it's very interesting to watch. And that's one of the advantages, if the mind gets quiet enough, you can watch how you relate to a thought that arises. You can watch the movement to latch onto it. You can watch the movement to buy into it. You can watch the movement to get caught in it. You can't watch that if you're only caught. You know, if you're only caught, then you don't see the new caughtness. You're just caught, right? That's how things are. And so you don't even know you're caught because that's all there is. But if you have the chance to separate from it and see, watch that movement. So thought is just a thought. And I find that, you know, throughout the day, that I'll have all kinds of thoughts that I'll just say, oh, leave that one alone. That doesn't have to go anywhere. Thank you. And not now. And that's very valuable. It saves a lot of suffering, a lot of problems. Another thing that happens as we get a handle on the world of thinking is that I lost the train of my thought. Isn't that something? I've been liberated. Oh yes, so this is what what comes first? An emotion or a thought? Sometimes if you're careful attention, it's really fascinating to watch the interplay between the different inner aspects of our life. It's fascinating to watch how there can be a thought and then emotion follows in response to it. And sometimes there's an emotion that arises and you see how there's a thought in response to that. Sometimes you can see there's a physical sensation in the body that arises and then in the wake of that there's an emotion or there's a thought. And there's a wonderful interplay between these different things. And it can give you a lot of, I don't know if it's the right word, a lot of power, a lot of advantage in your life if you start seeing that connection. Because you can sometimes see how certain thoughts give rise to certain feelings. And sometimes you can, if you see that connection, sometimes you can have some ability to moderate, modify how you're feeling by not buying into certain kinds of thoughts or letting go of them. So what comes first? So you can watch this. It's very fascinating to watch. Also, if your mind is very still, very quiet in meditation, and you've learned to separate yourself from the world of thinking, thin it out, mind is really, really quiet, and you start having gaps between your thoughts. You know, normal life probably is kind of just probably incessant, there's no gaps. But in meditation, there can be a gap. You think something, it disappears, there's a gap. Something else arises, it goes away. Something else, a thought arises, you can watch. If you're really subtle in meditation, sometimes you can watch the mind, the thinking begin taking you away into the world of thinking, into some thought train. And at the same, without even wishing it, without even willing it, the power of mindfulness is so strong, it's almost like there's an elastic band attached to thinking, and it pulls you back into the world of being present. You don't even have to even try anymore. It just pulls you back. The thought arises, you come right back. But then this very interesting time can happen, where mind is very quiet, no thinking is going on, and you can feel like a little bubble or a little pressure arise in the brain or in the mind somewhere. And you recognize it if you're about to have a thought. So you have this warning system. You have this, you know, symptom or this clue or this kind of the energy, the momentum to have a thought arises before you're aware you have the thought. Isn't that interesting? I think it's fascinating. And it's even better, more interesting, because if you can let go of that tendency to think before it's burst forth into a full-blown thought, it'll dissipate, relax, and you'll never know what that thought was. What does that say about our mind? What does it say about our mind that we can have a thought before it becomes conscious? Isn't that interesting? What's going on in there? What is going on in there? It's a black box. And it doesn't really, you know, so purpose of meditation doesn't matter that much, but what's interesting is that, you know, you can kind of no longer have the allure or the caughtness in the world of thinking. You can let go of it even before it begins, even before you're aware of what you're thinking about. And then that gives a sense of tremendous ease and peace and well-being to people. It also kind of indicates that one of the most important, one of the very important abilities we have in relationship to our thoughts is the veto power. We might not have ability to choose what we think, since it seems to some of our thinking starts before we've been aware that we're thinking, right? So you're not responsible for the thoughts that arise. But you're a little bit responsible for the train of thinking you get involved in. So you can have a really ugly thought. Don't take responsibility for it. Don't say, oh, this, don't take it personally. Don't define yourself by it. You can have the world's ugliest thought. You're not responsible. It just bubbles up. However, if you choose to get involved in that thought and act on it or do this and that, then you have responsibility. But you have, but human beings have the ability, especially if they're mindful, to have the veto power and say, no, not now, not that one. Let it go. And that ability to have veto power is a very important one in the mind. Say, no, I'm not going to get involved in that. Tanisara Bhikkhu, a Buddhist monk, he teaches this by the analogy of, and maybe it's an unfortunate analogy. Some people, I know some people have reacted negatively to this analogy and some people have loved it. And those people who have this experience in life, I hope they're not being picked on. It's like a corporate board. And according to, you know, Tanisara's image of a corporate board, you know, all these different board members, directors, they're all, you know, chaotic and they all have different ideas and, you know, the poor board president has no control, except the board president has the veto power. So nothing happens in the company because, you know, unless the CEO or something agrees, because at least he can veto, but he's no control of what the idea is coming up. So that's Sanjeev's analogy. But the veto power is very important. So do you have the ability to exercise that? Do you have the ability to see a thought arise, an idea arise, a motivation arise in your mind and say, no, and not make it any big deal. Not to judge yourself because of the presence of that thought. Not to come to any conclusion from its presence. No, no, not now. And then if it's a good thought, then you don't have to use your veto power. And then you can start using your wise thinking to engage in that. Which my hope is will be the topic for next week. And next week, we'll finally, this Buddhist teacher here will finally give the poor insecure thinking mind its chance to be respected and appreciated for its important role, and will help it to train it to become a more wise and useful member of the board. So I apologize I talk so long, because I thought it'd be useful to hear some of your questions and concerns around this topic. And perhaps we do have a couple of minutes before 9, if maybe one or two concerns or questions you might have. Yes, please.
What I've been trying to work with lately are waking up in the middle of the night after dreams that have a lot of, they're grabbing me. Mm-hmm. I think I've got a lot of things going on in the daytime world, and so they're completely unrelated things have the same clinginess coming up in dreams. But then I'm like hardly conscious, and it's very hard to let go. My mind keeps wanting to solve the dilemma mm-hmm. in the dream, and then I have a hard time getting back to sleep. I don't know whether you've got any twists on the advice you've given for thoughts.
And you have enough awareness during that time to know that you're uncomfortable and you want something different to happen?
Right. Yeah, but I have a hard time.
But you're not awake enough to make any decisions?
Right, yeah.
Tough. It's tough. Live with it. Thanks. What else could I say? you know, you might try to arouse yourself. If you want to arouse yourself, wake yourself up more. If you really want to kind of separate yourself, if you can't go back to sleep, try to wake yourself up. Get out of bed and go to the bathroom. Try to break the seduction, break the allure, break the trance you're in, or something. Maybe it requires me being more awake to have more ability to have some control over it, or some different relationship to it. The other thing is, there is a way, and there's many ways that people practice or relate to dreams. If you want to practice vipassana with dreams, then what we do is when you wake up from a dream, you don't get involved in the content of the dream, but rather you sit up in your bed, perhaps, or you're lying down, and you do mindfulness of the emotions that linger because of the presence of the dream. And you use the emotions and mindfulness of emotions to somehow process the experience of the dream. And the idea sometimes is that it can be more effective, more efficient, to process a dream through the world of mindfulness of emotions, mindfulness of the body, than it is through the mindfulness of symbolism and try to figure it all out and all that. So you can maybe also try that to give you a practice to do. And so drop into the world of your body, into the world of your emotions.
I like that idea. I'll try that one.
And then the other thing they say in Buddhist texts is that the quality of your dreams has a lot to do with the quality of the rest of your life. And so, for example, if you practice loving kindness before you go to sleep, some people think that it really has a big effect on their dreams at night because of the tone that's being set. So one more? Is that okay for one more? Yes. Up here in the front here. Here for Bill.
You spoke about becoming able to become aware of thoughts as they're about to arise, and then you can have the choice to let go of them before the thought is actually completed or even really started. I'm thinking that becomes possible when you get to where you can become very aware of your body, and then you can see the pressures that arise in your body from the energies that are about to produce a thought, so like an upwelling in your heart area or something like that. Is that sometimes how you can catch the thought?
I suppose that is the case. Sometimes you can feel upwelling energy or emotion stuff in your body that might precede a thought. But I was actually talking about much more subtle in meditation. You might actually not have much experience of your body at all. The body might actually disappear. It was very, very rarefied, very simple experience. Very, very little is left in meditation because everything's gotten so thin or so peaceful or so still. And then you can feel almost, you can almost feel or watch. Sometimes it feels like a feeling, sometimes more like something you see. But you can sort of sense like a pressure, a bubble that some people report they kind of feel. And then, but it's more like in the brain or something where the thinking mind is. And it's not so connected, I think, to all the energies of the body, this level. So the final thing I kind of want to say or repeat is that I think some of you will be very surprised how much power or how much strength you can tap into in your life, you can tap into if you can see a thought as just a thought and just leave a thought alone. Because you can have, if you, like for example, just now, I had a thought that I'm getting cold. I am getting cold. The air conditioner is a little bit cold. Right? So, but I kind of thought I'm getting cold, and I could watch my mind as I have the thought, that I could start having a relationship to, I'm getting cold. Oh, I got to do something about it. I better dismiss this all quickly. I better go up there and do something with the air conditioner. I better, maybe I'm going to get sick, and, I can get involved in that whole world. Or I can just see, oh, it's just a thought. I'm cold. And I don't have to do anything about it, just a thought. And so there's a tremendous ability to be free of things. Because so much of the world, the way we get caught by things, is through that world of thinking. And once you're not caught, you have much wider range of choice about how to respond. So, since I'm cold, we'll stop now. Thank you very much.